And we interview a few people and, you know, talk about the music that's happening. So please do join us for Vancouver Folk Music Festival. It's coming up really soon, just around the corner, actually. That's all I have time for here on Give 'Em the Boot. But before I go, I'm going to leave you with a little promo of another wonderful show that happens here at CITR called Rocket from Russia. And then stay tuned for Radio Free Thinker. That's all for me. Ciao a tutti. Ci sentiamo la settimana prossima.
Hey, Horace, give us 3 shots of your best bourbon. And have that Russian waiter I like bring it over.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Tune into CITR 101.9 FM every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. And you can also find the podcast on CITR.ca, iTunes, and my blog, rocketfromrussia.tumblr.com.
It's the No Bananas edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Too Big to Jail, our prairie correspondent talks about Neighbors, Fair Elections Law, Media Consolidation, Justin and the Pope, and yes, we have no more bananas. Let's begin episode 254.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
This week's wine is about Too Big to Jail. Some of our listeners may be aware that GM is in the midst of the largest number of recalls in car history. Now, recalls on one level are a good thing. If the manufacturer discovers a defect that made it past the design and testing phase, it issues a recall so it can fix the problem. However, this recall is not only horrific, but an affront to justice. You see, one of the problems that triggered the latest recall was a faulty ignition switch. It seemed that if your keyring was too heavy, it can cause the ignition switch to slip into park. That means that the power brakes are disabled, as well as the airbags and the power steering. If you were driving anywhere, be it on the highway or in the city, and suddenly you could not stop nor steer, and then you inevitably run into something, your airbag would fail to deploy. Well, let's just say GM has admitted 13 people have died. Most people think 10 times that number have likely been killed by this technical issue. But hey, who could have guessed people would have heavy keychains? As I said, the whole point of recall is to fix faults not known at the time of the deployment, and this does seem a little obscure. When they were doing testing, they couldn't have thought of testing something like that, could they? Well, it seems they did. From released documents, it seems GM has been aware of the problem for a decade. In fact, they knew it was a problem before, yes, before it went into production, and did so anyway. It seems once these facts came to light, largely thanks to an effective investigation of a lawyer of one of the victims, GM has done a complete mea culpa. Of course, they deny any wrongdoing and say that since the possible criminal act occurred before GM's bankruptcy, technically making it immune from any lawsuits before the bankruptcy, that it is in no way responsible, but would fix the problem, ergo the recall. The evidence is pretty clear. GM took a look at the possible cost of a recall versus the cost of paying off those that they killed. And well, the payoff was cheaper, so no recall was issued until they had no choice. I can't help but wonder if the GM executives who made this decision were fans of Fight Club. Okay, so they've been caught out. They knowingly allowed a defective car to proceed into production that they knew, or should have known, could not have not known, would kill people. Obviously, these executives have been arrested and are facing criminal persecution. No? No. What the feck, folks? It seems the U.S. Justice Department and GM lawyers have come to an agreement. GM admits they did nothing wrong, but will pay a fine of $35 million. To put that in perspective, GM makes over $10 million a day. So in less than 4 days, they have paid for the acknowledged murder of 13 people. Sweet deal. There's an irony here. I talked about how corporations have fought hard to gain the same rights as real people. Yet when it comes to justice, they seem to be fiction. And this is not unique. The people responsible for the crash of 2008, people like JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon, who cost the company billions by selling fraudulent financial instruments. Well, his company paid the largest fine in history, $13 billion. But he and all his minions who actually committed the crimes walk free. In fact, Dimon, in a way giving a bounty to an arsonist, Dimon walked away with a $20 million bonus for his efforts to burn down the world's economies. Oh, and if you think $13 billion hurts JP Morgan, well, they still managed to make $17 billion this year. Yes, let's cry for the decrease from 2012 where they made $21 billion. Yes, folks, that's billion with a B. The same is true for those involved in the LIBOR scandal. For those who do not know, LIBOR is an average interest rate estimated by leading banks in London that they would charge if borrowing from other banks. It has emerged that this rate was being manipulated by bankers for their own profit. How it works is a friend would call one of the people setting the interest rates. They might say, "Hey, I'm going to short a Citi bond. Could you set the rate lower today?" Friend says, "Sure," and the city is screwed and the trader makes another bonus. This manipulation is estimated to have cost U.S. cities, states, counties, and local governments at least $6 billion in fraudulent interest payments. Fraudulent because the interest rates were charged so as to ensure these entities would pay more, thus increasing fees, commissions, bonuses, and margins other traders have made. Anyway, you can check out our show notes about this scandal. The point being, Barclays Bank, one bank caught doing this manipulation, was fined less than $500 million. UBC, also implicated, paid a little over $1 billion. Again, it may seem that that hurt Barclays, but it seems its profits are up over $5 billion. UBS is posting a 23% increase in its profits, also measured in the billions. So to return to my theme, it seems that if I were to steal or defraud people of even $100, I would likely be heading to jail. But if I defraud a country billions of dollars, well, the state takes a cut in the profits via fines, and the people who actually forced grandma out of her home, who destroyed your uncle's retirement investment, who forced your city to close schools, well, they get a $1 million bonus. And just to let you know how deep this rabbit hole goes, it started to emerge that HSBC was laundering money for drug cartels and terrorist groups. They even went so far as to create special money boxes so as to facilitate the money exchange between the drug dealers and the bank. Over $9 billion was laundered in Mexico alone, and that's cash dollars. HSBC acknowledged that it ignored warning signs of money laundering and that staff had stripped identifying information on transactions made to the United States from countries facing economic sanctions such as Iran and Sudan. HSBC was fined $1.9 billion U.S., or about 5 weeks of profit. And who went to jail? No one. Assistant U.S. Attorney General Lanny Brower said, quote, "Our goal is not to bring HSBC down. It's not to cause a systemic effect in the economy. It's not for people to lose thousands of jobs." Again, WTF. So by this logic, they should fine the mob and even said drug cartel people, and not arrest them because they employ thousands of people. This is where the term too big to jail comes from. But even if I accepted this perverse logic, and honestly, I don't understand why you couldn't nationalize an offending company, keeping it running, keeping people employed, and then sell it off later. I don't know. But regardless, irrespective of the corporation, why are not the executives and other operatives or employees not being arrested? For example, HSBC employees who scrubbed the info so that money could go to terrorist groups. Why can't you indict them, even if you don't indict the company itself? And who was arrested for the financial meltdown in 2008? Why is it not the CEOs or the engineer who signed off allowing a known defective ignition switch to go into production? Why are they not in jail? There is something fundamentally wrong with a nation when this kind of justice is allowed to exist. I don't believe in capital punishment, but it strikes me as odd that some people would kill a man for taking another man's life, but think nothing of just fining a man's employer if they cause the death and the desolation of millions. Corporations are not people, that is true. But it's also true that they are under the control of real people who must, let me reiterate, must be held accountable when they break the law. Allow me to return to the GM scandal. How can you not say that the people who decided not to fix the known defect that caused the deaths before the car was released to the public? How is that not premeditated murder? I am apoplectic. I have an urge for vengeance. And the vengeance is not focused on the psychotic people who operate with impunity, these corporations that kill, bankrupt, and wreak havoc with impunity, but our politicians who allow this to be acceptable. There are people rotting in jail because they had two joints on them. And if it was their third offense, they're in jail for life. That's not an offense. That's offensive. How long are we as a society, as a nation, as moral people going to sit back and let this injustice, let this abomination continue? I urge our listeners to go to their computer, to go to our website and click on Let My Voice Be Heard link. It will let you tell your local MP, the party leaders, our dictatorial prime minister, well, that you are mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore. We feel powerless. The system is stacked against us. But at its root is real democracy. If only we were bold enough to take it. I urge every listener to be bold, to take that step beyond and make a difference. I alone cannot do it, but we can. 2015, never forget. We'll return after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Neighbors. We all want to be good neighbors, and we all want to have good neighbors. Mostly our neighbors are the people next door, either down the hallway or down the street. Neighbors are usually close enough to know each other, if not intimately, at least by sight. If the walls are thin enough and the windows are open, sometimes they know each other more than's comfortable. We know the comings and the goings, the different vehicles, the new siding. When the plumber comes a-calling, we may not know why, but we'll figure it out. The guy who parks his truck on the lawn and the one that's down on his hands and knees pulling the dandelions out by hand. A neighborhood is full of all types of people. Neighborhoods can be welcoming places, and some can be anything but. Like the barbecue that the Smiths had and invited everyone on the south side of the street but the Hanna family. Everyone else got along, as did the Hannas and the Smiths, until one weekend when the RV arrived. Something happened, nobody's sure what. All that were invited went. They noticed the Hannas weren't there. They talked among themselves, and no one said anything to the Smiths. After all, it wasn't their party, or their yard, or their food for that matter. What right did they have to say who the Smiths could invite and who not? This fight didn't go unnoticed either by the Hannas. It was a small block, and they noticed the people passing their yard on the way to the Smiths. Well, the Hannas didn't care, because they liked the Smiths just about as little as the Smiths liked them. Well, truth be known, after the puffing of feathers and the bravado, they cared a great deal. You see, the two neighbors used to be friends. Heck, they borrowed each other's tools and returned them. Now that's a good neighbor. It all started one day when the Smiths brought home a spanking new RV, 39 feet long with fold-out sides, a magnificent RV to the Smiths, but a monster to the Hannas. The fallout wasn't over the jealousy. The Hannas were glad the Smiths had the RV. They had four small boys, and they too could imagine the fun ahead for the family. What the Hannas objected to was the RV had been parked in the driveway as far back as possible, and the RV's large window lined up perfectly with the Hannah's sun deck, patios, and all of the backyard for that matter. Now, as much as anyone might like the people next door, there are limits. The same reason people build fences, plant trees, and build pergolas was the same reason the Hannas found a problem with the RV. They liked their privacy. When Mrs. Hannah awoke the next morning and rounded the table in the kitchen, she was staring straight into the window of the RV. It was parked 6 inches from the dividing fence. Usually, Mr. Hannah was a more forgiving sort, but he too stared at it, eyes bulging. There was room in the driveway to pull ahead. Therefore, solve the problem, so what the double H-E-L? The nerve! So out they go, after cramming down their breakfast, fit to be tied. They erected a makeshift line with wood and an old sheet, blocking the RV's view of their property. Looked crappy, but they wanted to make a point. And after all, what were the Smiths thinking? And it escalated from there. And this leads to the night of the barbecue. The Smiths and the Hannahs never talked. The neighbors looked the other way. Was it perhaps the Hannahs' fault? If they'd voiced their problem with the way the RV was parked in the driveway, explained the discomfort it caused, or was it perhaps the Smiths' fault if they'd taken the Hannahs' right to privacy into account? It could have hashed it out, came to an agreement that worked for both of them. It may be a simple conversation could have alleviated the situation that developed. And isn't that the way of the world? We're all neighbors, some of us closer than others, and our block is the planet. The planet Earth is our neighborhood. Perhaps we should make an effort to listen and talk to our neighbors. Good neighbors. We all want to be good neighbors, and we all want to have good neighbors, don't we? Thanks for listening. This is Dal McClenaghan, Radio Free Thinkers, Prairie Correspondents, and folks, let's make tomorrow better than today.
There's a guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. I have railed against the Unfair Election Act many times on the show. I have tried to rally protest against the act, and have reported on the bill's progress and hope for death. Sadly, we have failed. Just recently, the Fair Election Act was passed into law. Mid-May, it had its third and final reading in the House of Commons, where it passed. It now just awaits a token vote in the Senate, one Governor General's signature, and the fix is in on the next election. Okay, not a fix maybe, but the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition said the bill went from very bad to just bad. The final bill did amend some of the most egregious proposals. So what was the amendment, you ask? Well, a form of vouching has remained. I say a form, as you will still have to provide two pieces of ID to prove you are who you say you are, but you can now have someone from the same polling district vouch that you live in the riding you are voting in. This will still disenfranchise a number of people, first-time voters who may not have two pieces of ID, the very poor, the very old. And here's another scenario. If you're new to a neighborhood and yet have nothing with your new address on it, and you don't know anyone in the new neighborhood or polling district, you got trouble. That said, its impact will be minimized by the change. However, the Conservatives are using a tactic used by the Republicans south of the border. What is that tactic? Voter ID laws. The mantra of voter ID to stop voter fraud has disenfranchised millions in America. And now Harper has brought this campaign north. It is a statistical fact that small-c Conservative Party supporters tend to be older, middle to upper income, and settled. They are also the group most likely to have voter ID. Those who tend not to have ID are those who are young, poor, or marginalized. These people tend not to vote for the Conservative Party. So, by promoting voter suppression via voter ID laws, Harper will impact the NDP and Liberal base the most while hardly touching his own. How convenient. As it is, 400,000 people use the voter information card, the thing you get in the mail with your name and address saying you are legally allowed to vote at your polling station. Well, it seems this is not good enough for the conservatives, where you think it would actually be the best form of ID. We'll have to wait and see how many people will be denied their right to vote for lack of voter ID in the next election. Another very bad to just bad change is Elections Canada will not be completely prohibited from promoting higher voter turnout. The original bill would have Elections Canada strictly limited to only communicating how to vote, where to vote, and when to vote, and how to be a candidate. The current bill explicitly gives Elections Canada a role in educating school kids. The bill now states that Elections Canada may implement public education and information programs to make the electoral process better known to students at the primary and secondary level. It's a little fuzzier about what can be said to the rest of us. There is the addition of the line, for greater certainty, subsection 1, the how, when, and where limits, does not prevent the chief electoral officer from transmitting or causing to be transmitted advertising messages of any other purpose relating to his or her mandate. The potential problem here is I can find no definition of the chief electoral officer's mandate. And note, we've made a shift here from Elections Canada to the chief electoral officer. Not that there is no definition of his duties, but the term mandate is absent. It also makes a distinction between the chief electoral officer's personal speech versus communications from Elections Canada as a whole, as I've already sorry mentioned. I worry about this because the Senate committee asked for a clarification of Elections Canada's new, quote, reduced role that ends the promotion of democracy. They use the term reduced role, it's not mine. So it will not affect Election Canada's working relationship with electoral educational programs in elementary and high school. Does this mean Elections Canada cannot actually promote democracy to adults? It seems to. In fact, several observers warned Election Canada's programs aimed at boosting civic literacy would also be cut because it's not within Bill C-23's new strict mandate for the CEO. It'll mean no ads from Election Canada encouraging people or groups with particular low voter turnout to cast a ballot. It will apparently spell the end to some civic literacy initiatives, which critics pan as short-sighted at a time of low voter turnout. Another more obviously good thing is the robocall records have been extended from 1 year to 3 years. The fact that a registry is being created for both who calls and what was said is a little surprising, and yet not surprising at all. Because of the robocall scandal that showed everything up to what was, but not quite provable in court, conservative election fraud, they had to do something, and they did the least they could, but at least is better than nothing. Another change is the winning party in a riding will not be allowed to nominate or appoint election officials. Can you believe this was even proposed? If this was kept in, the people responsible for ensuring a fair election would be party hacks. Again, another thing that Harper is trying to import from south of the border. Many, I don't have the figures handy, but many electoral ridings in the U.S. are actually run by biased party officials. If one remembers back to the coup of 2000, where election officials who tried successfully to stop a count, well, those were Republican Party members, not to mention that the voter list was created and tainted by the Republican Secretary of State for Florida to reduce eligible Democratic voters. Parties will still have to count advertising as part of their campaign spending. Again, another good change. Two changes, however, will open the door to wealthier candidates, who could be able to donate as much as $5,000 to their campaign and up to $25,000 of their own personal money to a party leadership campaign specifically. Presently, the limits for those are just $1,000. Of course, that's on top of the $1,200 limit, which means, of course, a candidate can give up to currently $2,200. Under the new rules, the limits are higher, but the proposed new $1,500 general donation won't be tracked. This, of course, will only increase the divide between the people who represent us and the people they supposedly represent. In the U.S., where the more money, the more votes, the majority of congressmen are millionaires and many multimillionaires. Why? Because you need a lot of money just to run for office, let alone get elected. And if you already have the money, it's much easier. It seems Harper is hoping to gentrify our parliament, make most MPs the 1%, not to mention that donations and spending were raised across the board, allowing more dollars to Trump votes. Another half change was to allow the Chief Electoral Officer and the Commissions for Elections Canada to exchange information and documents and allow the Commissioner to publicly disclose information about investigations that are in the public interest. Take note, the Commissioner of Canada Elections is the enforcement arm of our electoral system. So he's the one that goes out and investigates and proposes charges against people who may have violated the elections law. Not changed, however, is that the Commissioner has a lot of limitations as to why he discloses this information. One wonders to whom the Commissioner must justify public interest. It is likely the threat of censure will silence the Commissioner and keep Canadians in the dark about wrongdoings of politicians. What was not changed? The position of the Commissioner of Canada's Elections is now within the office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, this may not sound like nothing more than shifting offices, but one thing does change. Today, the Elections Commissioner is accountable and responsible to Parliament as a whole. By shifting the extremely important enforcement arm to the DPP, you have now made them accountable not to Parliament, but to a government minister, which, as we know and have seen many times, does not act as Canada's government, but Harper's government. Besides the move of office, it shifts the appointment of the Commissioner of Elections from the Chief Electoral Officer to a federal civil servant. This will bring into question items such as true independence, freedom of action, what items are pursued. It politicizes what is currently an apolitical position. Bill C-23 didn't grant the Commissioner of Elections Canada the power to compel testimony to enforce Canada's Election Act. If they really wanted to give Elections Canada teeth when it comes to stopping election fraud and other shenanigans, then providing the Commissioner with the power to compel testimony would have had strong impact. One of the reasons a number of investigations have gone nowhere is because those who could provide information have clammed up. This power would force people to testify. It should be noted, many jurisdictions, like Manitoba, where I was born, give the Commissioner the power to compel testimony. Now, I know a number of you might say that that's kind of unconstitutional. Well, first, it's a gray area where such testimony would be a self-incriminator. Many times the information sought is actually about others. So just to make it clear, if you refuse to testify in court, excluding self-incrimination, that is called contempt of court, i.e., it's a crime that can result in fines and indefinite jail time. Secondly, in Canada, we have adopted for a rights with limitations approach. So if the greater good outweighs the impact of the infringement, then the right can be limited. The Government of Canada said that the Commissioner has the same powers of the RCMP, that if need be, the Commissioner can ask for a warrant to obtain documents. That's true, but one must take into account everything the RCMP is investigating is a criminal offense. Often the Commissioner is investigating regulatory offenses. This would not be eligible for warrants. Many times the Commissioner's investigation is to identify if there was an offense, such as the robocall scandals. The current Commissioner, Yves Cote, has said his investigation into robocalls that misdirected voters to the wrong polling stations during the 2011 campaign was stymied by his inability to compel uncooperative Conservative Party operatives to talk to investigators. Take note, I added the Conservative part, but you get the idea. In question period, NDP leader Tom Mulcair inferred that wrongdoing by the Conservative Party was the rationale behind refusing to grant the powers to compel testimony. He said, to quote, "We now learn that the Conservative Party lawyer, Arthur Hamilton, was caught giving false information to Elections Canada investigators in the robocall scandal. Is this why the Conservatives will not give elections fraud investigators the power to compel testimony? Because it would be used to prosecute the Conservatives who are lying?" Another glaring omission is the failure to give elections officer the investigative powers to compel political parties and their riding associations to provide financial documents to support their financial returns. Canada reimburses candidates and parties for some of the costs of running a campaign, Right now, candidates have to turn in receipts to back up that spending. Federal parties, however, do not, despite submitting $66 million in expenses after the 2011 election. These expenses were reimbursed at 50%, meaning taxpayers provided $33 million in refunds, but have no receipts to show where this money actually went to. Again, if the real purpose of the Fair Election Act was to improve democracy, you would think that they would have taken a lesson from the Yanks and make parties more accountable. But alas, 'tis not to be. Like the power to compel testimony, the requirement to provide appropriate expense documentation would have actually improved the system. Unless you were a conservative party that was convicted of an in-and-out scandal. Some other minor bits. It also fails to hold political parties accountable for the authorized use of their databases by those who have accessed it. One of the biggest unknowns is how the conservative database was used to make the illegal robocalls in the first place. It also requires the commissioner to inform a politician in writing if they are going to be investigated for a breach of election law. A statutory heads up not provided to anybody else in the broader society. When you couple this with the lack of investigatory powers, i.e. compel testimony or impound documents, well, this is what every criminal would want. Imagine if the RCMP had to provide written notice to a drug dealer that they were beginning to investigation into their trade. The first thing the dealer would do is rush home and flush any incriminating evidence. What do you think a political actor is going to do if they know they are being looked at? Put the shredder on overtime. I'm going to close this segment. Professor Paul Thomas, who is testifying before Procedural and House Affairs Committee, where he broached this idea. I start with the observation there has been considerable decline in public trust and confidence in politics and democracy in Canada. A similar trend has been happening in established democracies. There are many long-term causes and short-term factors that have contributed to public disillusionment with the political process. I fear that both the process by which Bill C-23 was formulated and is being passed in Parliament and the substance of the bill will further weaken public trust and confidence in the integrity of the election process, the one democratic activity in which the majority of Canadians participate. Sound electoral governance arrangements, based on as much as consensus as possible, contribute in important ways to public trust and confidence in the election process and to democratic legitimacy. Turning to the process of election law, on process, I would observe that the Canadian Elections Act is not ordinary legislation. It provides a foundation and framework for fair and free elections. Other countries have recognized that such fundamental laws should not be changed hastily and unilaterally by a governing party. In the UK, most election laws require advanced consultation with the National Electoral Commission. Usually this involves a review of draft bills with the Commission officials to ensure that the proposed legislation is workable. In New Zealand, the Election Act of 1993 requires a supermajority of members of the House of Representatives to repeal or modify a list of 8 key features of the election law framework. This provision ensures that there is some measure of cross-party support for these changes. This leads me to recommend that the bill be amended to provide a mandatory consultation with Election Canada concerning future changes to the Canadian Elections Act. On that note, we'll return after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. I thought it was high time that we discussed the concentration of media here in Canada. What do I mean by media concentration? Well, I don't mean the number of people who own TVs, tablets, or the like. No, I'm talking about the media we view, hear, and get on these kind of devices. There are two ways to look at media concentration in Canada. First, there's who owns what media outlet, and then there's who distributes these media outlets. First are the media makers. Think TV, newspapers, that sort of thing. I counted a number of newspapers, the Vancouver Sun, the Province, the Globe and Mail, and the National Post, just to see how much diversity we have in our own local newspaper scene. It would seem on the surface that we actually have quite a bit. But when you dig down a little bit, you find out that the Vancouver Sun, the Province, and the National Post are all owned by Post Media. So really, we have the appearance of choice, but in reality, not so much. Okay, that's print media, and people have been predicting its death for decades. What about TV? Well, it is true that the number of TV stations have risen. The number of people who own those stations, though, have shrunk. At one time, Vancouver had four independent and separate TV stations, CBC, CTV, Global, CTV. Now, with the exception of the CBC, these are actually all parts of larger mega media empires. CTV is owned by Bell, Global is owned by Shaw, and Roger owns City TV. But this is over-the-air channels, and you might say, well, I have cable. There are hundreds of channels there. And that's true, kinda. Most of the stations on cable or satellite are not Canadians. Those that are based in Canada, well, about 95% of them are owned by the top three, Shaw, Bell, and Rogers, with Shaw and Bell accounting for 75% alone. What does this mean? Well, when a story breaks, maybe one about allowing foreign competition into Canada's wireless market, that maybe some of these stations may get a call or just know how to get their next promotion. Well, the editors may ignore the story or only briefly cover it and then bury it just after the corn price updates. Or maybe they will call in experts that will point out that our current market is already saturated, that foreign business will not have Canadian interests at heart, that we must rally around the flag or something. One of the greatest things about the CBC is its purity of message, especially if funded sufficiently and reliably. It has no other master than you and me, the people of Canada, and there's no special interest it must keep in mind when following a story. Public broadcaster only has the one interest, Canada. All, and I mean all the other ones, have only one master too. That's its board of directors, who by law must put profit ahead of all other interests, like yours and mine. Okay, so Canada has, I believe, the highest media concentration, i.e. fewest number of owners to media outlet. But it gets worse. The other aspect of media concentration is delivery of media content. That is, cable and satellite owners, through which media outlets are connected to viewers. I'm going to exclude into this IPTV, or Internet over TV. This is services like TELUS would provide via optical, and Bell has a limited IPTV service, but this only accounts for like 2.5% of the market share. The vast majority of multi-channel TV enters the home via satellite or cable. In Canada, we have three main companies that deliver media content to our home: Bell, Rogers, and Shaw. Each have a quarter of the share. The other 25% is spread amongst the TELUSes and Quebecors of the nation. Small players overall. Now, beyond the problem of having such concentration of both media makers and media distributors is, in itself, troubling. But the degree of vertical integration is shocking. Vertical integration, in this context, is a company that not only creates the media, but was also the distributor of said media. And no, I don't mean the CBC making The Nature of Things and then broadcasting it on CBUT. No, I mean when Bell, which owns CTV, takes a CTV show such as Motive, and then is also the one responsible via satellite distribution, think Bell Express View, for getting it into people's homes. Now this may seem a little esoteric, but let's compare Canada to the rest of the world with regards to ownership of content and distribution. So compared to the G7, these are the developed nations with the top economies of the world, well, the least integrated, this is where there's the least overlap between production and distribution. Well, that's Germany, with 7.1%. The midpoint, i.e. the median number 4 player, is Italy, at 33%. Number 6 on the list is Japan, at a little over 37%. And Canada? Well, if we look back to 2009, It was about 40%, which is high, but kind of in line with the others. What is it now? 81.4%. Wow, that is jaw-dropping. Why is this important? Well, when you have one part of the company who distributes product, our shows, from many different producers, when another part is also a producer, there is a vested interest for that company to either hinder its competition or give favorite status to itself. You see this in wireless already. If you watch Netflix on your phone, it counts toward your bandwidth limit. But if you watch Bell's own movie service, it doesn't. Put more clearly, there's a direct conflict of interest. This means that if another channel, let's say the CBC, were to broadcast a sporting event, well, Bell would have a vested interest in causing problems, because it also owns TSN, a rival. Or even, if a new channel is wanting to get itself onto cable, maybe you heard recently the CRTC complain that there's not enough Canadian content in our porn channels, which, for a quick trivia point, are all owned by one company except for the gay one. Anyway, maybe I think I could do better, so I start up my own. Meanwhile, Shaw buys that one company and now is Porn King of Canada. Is it likely to let me on to its cable service? No, it has a vested interest to impede me from being successful. This leads nicely into the idea of net neutrality. In recent events, net neutrality is essentially dead in the USA. What is net neutrality, you may ask? Well, it's the concept that the internet and those people who provide the connectivity, called ISPs, or internet service providers, well, that this is a utility, that they should be regulated like telephones, that anyone on the internet can connect equally with anyone else on the internet. And by connect equally, I mean speed. That there's a single speed limit on the internet roads, and no one gets a fast lane nor a slow lane. Well, in the US, this is no longer the case. Internet providers like Comcast have just signed an agreement with Netflix to provide Netflix preferential treatment on their network. On the one hand, you may say, great, capitalism at work. I would say, crap, capitalism at work. By allowing established businesses, in this case Netflix, to protect their interests by ensuring their service is going to be faster than any startup, well, it has put itself on the road to monopoly. Now, Canada technically has taken a pro-net neutrality stance vis-a-vis CRTC regulations. That said, the CRTC just approved usage-based billing. Although the regulations are in place to make the net neutral, enforcement of those regulations are very lax. Routinely, Bell, Eastlink, Rogers, Shaw throttle certain kind of internet traffic, like BitTorrents, and TELUS outright blocks some sites critical of its operations. So let's return to media concentration, which includes the internet as well. We see that, with the exception of the CBC, all sources of information, entertainment, and distributions have been winnowed down to Bell, Rogers, and Shaw. Of these, only Bell is publicly owned. The others are controlled by the Rogers and Shaw families, respectively. A hell of a lot of power to put into one family's hands. There have been attempts to rectify this media malady, but these have been all pushed by the opposition, and because we live in a parliamentary dictatorship, none have passed. There is hope that come the election of 2015, Harper's reign will come to an end, and things like net neutrality and media diversity will become laws in this nation, and we collectively can awaken from the corporate-induced stupor and reclaim our rights as steward of our proud nation. 2015, never forget. We return after this break.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right out. I'm red as a bee, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Hello, and we're back. Now, as our listeners may know, I'm not a big fan of religion. On the show, we have more than once crossed swords with the biggest religion, Catholicism. So it may not surprise you that I have an opinion about a recent debate that has occurred with one of our elected party leaders. Yes, I'm referring to Justin Trudeau and his stance on abortion. Now, it seems that Justin is a good Catholic, like devout Catholic, as was his father before him, who apparently would read Bible passages to the kids as a fun thing. To quote Justin, "I had an extraordinary example in a father who had deeply, deeply held personal views that were informed by the fact that he went to church every Sunday, read the Bible regularly to us, and raised us as very religious as Catholic. So you think that his attitude towards abortion would be, never is too much." Well, it seems that Justin, like his father, believed, if I may paraphrase, the government has no business in a woman's uterus. Both were publicly pro-choice, while personally against abortion. The father believed, and the son believed, that as a leader of the nation, they're there to promote the nation's interest, and not their theocratic ones. Again, to quote Justin, "He too held fast to his beliefs. But at the same time, my father had no problem legalizing divorce, decriminalizing homosexuality, and moving in ways to recognize the basic rights of people. He understood that as leader, as a political figure, and as a representative of the larger community, our utmost responsibility is to stand up for people's rights. And for that, I commend him. But I'm still not voting liberal." But from here, it becomes complicated, and you might want to sit down for this one. Why this is news, firstly, is Justin has denied the application of a liberal candidate on the grounds that that person is anti-abortion. You'll never hear me actually use the term pro-life as a description, because these people usually are not pro-life because they're also pro-capital punishment. And that's a biased word. Anti-abortion is accurate, and I don't think it's really judgmental. So I'm a bit torn on this one. I've talked before how Harper, as party leader, essentially can dictate to the MPs because they require his signature on their nomination papers. This is a power held by all party leaders. And it would seem to me to be hypocritical if I didn't complain about Justin using it in this case, although I do support his reasoning. The original logic of the sign-off was to ensure that local constituent associations could not nominate, or more embarrassingly, elect candidates who were in opposition either to the party leader or the main party doctrines. It also provided a way for parties, via the leader, to filter out cranks or embarrassing nominees who may be overtly racist or the like. As a side note, the party leaders only gained this power in 1993, so we're not talking about some long-standing tradition. But getting back to Justin, I am sure Justin saw himself justified under both of the reasons I've mentioned. But should this power be vested into one person's hand, even a group of hands? In a very real way, this is democracy thwarted. The party members of the riding, where the individual comes from, are now denied the opportunity to select the castaway as their nominee. The people of the riding are denied the opportunity to send their candidate to Ottawa. You know, thinking about it, I cannot help but wonder if the situations were kind of reversed. What if Justin denied the nomination of a pro-choice candidate? I can excuse Justin in this case because, as he rightly pointed out, the nomination should have been squashed at the local level because the candidate does not believe in the fundamental rights of Canadians, and the possibility of his election would be corrosive to those rights. Now, it would normally end on some great oratorical magnificence, but this story has developed more. As I mentioned, Justin is a Catholic, and maybe we should ban all people of religion from holding office. Why such a radical call? Well, it started with the Archbishop of Toronto requesting that Justin allow nominees to exercise their consciousness. Code words for letting people express their biases and bigotry. However, this was taken up a couple of notches when the Archbishop of Ottawa saw this as a kind of outing of Justin as a pro-choice supporter. He referred to Trudeau as scandalous to be both a practicing Catholic and pro-choice. He even threatened to deny communion, perhaps even excommunication of Justin, if he did not change his ways. The Archbishop of Ottawa said if the Liberal leader continued to practice his Catholic faith in the form of receiving communion, it would be unseemly. Quote, "Ultimately, he would have to make a public traction of his views. It's the fact that he considers himself a devout Catholic, but then adheres to or advocates for abortion. At no point does Justin advocate or adhere to abortion. His stance is, I may assume, I, Justin, think abortion is wrong, but that's my belief, and you're free to have your own. The Toronto Archbishop said, quote, political leaders surely have a right to insist on party unity in political matters which are with legislative scope of their authority. But that political authority is not limitless. It does not extend to matters of consciousness and religious faith. I find it so ironic that some complain about people suppressing their right to suppress other people's rights. And religion is again trying to carve out a special space where common decency and reason are not allowed to operate. But getting back to my point, I will assume that Justin is not really Catholic, or perhaps a cultural Catholic, as so many people and especially politicians are today. So this will not likely cause him to change his views. But what if he really, really, really was Catholic, believed in the whole heaven and hell thing? Do we really want to have a Prime Minister of Canada, someone who puts the dictates of Rome ahead of those of the people? You see, if you believe in hell, well, irrespective of the harm you might believe that will be done in this world by your actions, the reward of true faith will always outweigh that. This is one of the reasons that I suspect pedophiles were allowed to go unchecked in the church, in, well, all religions, because whatever harm that might be done to the small child is nothing compared to an eternity of damnation if they somehow question their faith. The root of the logic is that protecting the church is more important than anything. Praise be to Jesus. We'll return after this break.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Hello, and we're back. We've announced many times in this show the death of one thing or another, be it coffee, chocolate, what have you. But this week, it hits hard at home. By the time you hear this, there may be no more bananas. Ever. Anywhere. Okay, it's not all that bad. But for the second time, our beloved yellow proof of God may go extinct thanks to Big Agra. So first, a little history. Have you ever bought banana pudding or banana pie and thought to yourself, this doesn't really taste like a banana? Well, if I may use my trademark phrase, yes and no. As it turns out, artificial banana flavor was developed long ago when the prevalent banana was the Gros Michel. However, because of a fungus called Panama disease, the Gros Michel has been driven to the brink of extinction. This was a big thing. You see, the Gros Michel was the perfect food. It had a tough outer skin. It was not too quick to ripen. So you could just grab a bunch, throw them in the hold of a ship, send them to America or wherever, and sell them cheap. If you ever watch old movies and you see, usually black people, lifting bunches of bananas into the ship, well, they're not moving our bananas, they're moving the Gros Michels. One of the things that made bananas, well, the GMO version of bananas, was the fact that we bred out the seeds. If you ever eat a banana, look closely, you'll see little black specks. This is all that remains of the seeds of the bananas. And, well, they don't work anymore. So they're not really, I guess, seeds anymore. Modern bananas are infertile as a bishop at a boy's school. What? Too edgy? So every banana is a clone of the mother banana. This is what we call monoculture. This is what Big Agra likes. Monoculture does to farming what the production line does to manufacturing. That is why a banana is cheaper than an apple. Why we will buy more bananas than apples and oranges combined. We like cheap. Although it is true that monoculture is great for efficiency, it does have one major drawback. Let's return to the Gros Michel and the banana pudding. Because every commercial banana was a clone, when one fungus figured out how to infect it, well, quickly the entire global supply of bananas was dead. At the time, in the 50s and 60s, there was a substitute available, the Cavendish banana, the one we eat now. This was quickly brought into production to replace the Gros Michel. However, the Cavendish was more bland, less sweet, ergo the discrepancy between fake banana pie and real banana pie. Why haven't pudding makers changed their formula? Well, frankly, the Gros Michel just tastes better. As a side note, one of the reasons for the various coups in the 50s and 60s was because companies like Chiquita and Dole needed new plantations quickly to grow these new banana crops. This is where the term Banana Republic comes from. So, 50 years later, and the Pano disease has learned how to infect the Cavendish banana. Current attempts to isolate the disease have failed. It has just recently jumped continents. It first arose in Southeast Asia, but is now endemic in Africa. If it makes the inevitable leap to the Americas, well, game over, man. Game over. Why did this happen to the banana and not apples? Thank monoculture. Because everyone in the Western world eats one banana, the Cavendish, well, when one dies, they all die. You do not have genetic diversity of a wild crop to protect it against a beast like Panama disease. Just to make everyone depressed, yes, it has been one of those weeks. Monoculture is just not proactive in bananas, but in wheat, corn, rice, soya, and many others. A disaster just waiting to happen. Anyway, what can we do? Well, the simple solution, in scare quotes, is to genetically modify the Cavendish to be resistant to the fungus. Some manufacturers are working on this, but a bit more proactive than they were before, having learned a partial lesson from the Gros Michel. This may work out, but only postpones the disaster. As Jeff Goldblum once said, nature will find a way. The real cure is to limit monoculture and encourage diversity. You see, you may have gotten the impression that the death of the Cavendish is the death of the banana. That's not true. There are thousands of varieties of bananas out there in the world. In fact, in Africa, the average person eats like 10 bananas a day. Well, at least in certain parts of Africa. It's a major part of their diet. The problem for you and me is, well, they don't transport well. You see, a crop like East African Highland banana, while it is a great source of calories, it starts to ripen immediately after being cut from the tree. Meaning it is good locally, but not something that will make it to the supermarkets of the West. What I would propose is to diversify the banana choice. You see, Big Agra had a choice. It could specialize distribution systems to deal with a lot of different kinds of bananas, or just one. They chose the one, and we again face Bananageddon. If you go back a century, Big Agra was invested in breeding programs to produce different varieties of commercial bananas. That's why the Cavendish was handy when the Gros Michel died. But having not learned their lesson, current corporations stopped unprofitable research programs in favor of profitable distribution solutions. So until recently, there have been next to no attempts to find alternatives to the Cavendish. That said, having gone through this once, Big Agra is rallying, but is being stymied by the anti-GMO lobby. There are efforts to stop the blight in Uganda, but activists are trying to stop the deployment of fungus-resistant bananas because they are, quote, unnatural. Ha! But more on that joke later. But you sleep in the bed you made. If Big Agra had taken the opportunity they did with apples, where we have dozens of varieties, yes, we pay more for them, but they are so much more sustainable for our tables. You can't help push for this change. As my loyal listeners may know, I am no fan of organic or alternative supermarkets. Most of what they peddle is bunk, but it's one of the few places where you can actually find alternative bananas. If we exercise the invisible hand, we may be able to make the world a more banana-friendly world tomorrow. Oh yes, there's another reason why I love bananas. And note, I'm referring to the Cavendish variety. It is both a great example of genetic engineering, as well as a great debunker of the natural fallacy. That is, all things natural are good. So firstly, the banana is probably the most genetically modified organism on the planet, with the possible exception of the moo cow, but even the cow can make other cows. As already mentioned, Every banana you eat is a clone, a sterile clone. Bananas in the wild, beyond being seeded, are also quick to ripen and have delicate skins. Cavendish are tough and really only start to ripen when prompted to. Beyond being a GMO, bananas are also likely the most radioactive substance in your fridge. Bananas are rich in potassium, including potassium 40, which is radioactive. And now this is no lightweight isotope. It has a half-life of 1.25 billion, that's a B, billion years. In fact, there's a thing called banana equivalent dose, which is an informal expression of ionizing radiation exposure, intended as a general educational example to indicate the potential dose due to naturally occurring radioactive isotopes by eating one average-sized banana. It works out to be 0.1 microsieverts. For reference, an x-ray of your arm is about 1 microsievert. So for every 10 bananas, you're getting one x-ray. Ah! Okay, in context, if you live in a stone, brick, or concrete building, you're getting 70 millisieverts a year. So that would be like 700 bananas a year, or two a day. Worried yet? Did you know that bananas are the biggest selling item at Walmart?